Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books and Christian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ryan Shelton, and today we're joined by Dr. Matthew Rowley, author of Trump and the Protestant Reaction to Make America Great Again, just published in 2021 by Routledge. Dr. Rowley's timely and accessible book is something of a study in partisan historiography, as he examines three different approaches to history within American Protestantism in response to the candidacy, presidency, and legacy of Donald Trump. It's a pleasure to have you, Matt. Congratulations on the new book and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
We're eager to hear more about what you've written, but first, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to work on this project.
Sure. So I started out in biblical studies and did a Master's of Divinity and Master of Theology at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis. And it was there that I really got interested in the issue of history and the imitation of biblical violence. And so I worked on how people construct the view that their side is righteous in any given conflict. So from there, I moved on to the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom, where I worked on Protestantism and warfare, looking in particular at the history of Puritan violence in the Atlantic world. So that was looking at the theology of Puritan warfare as they fought against fellow Anglicans, Scottish Presbyterians, Irish Catholics, and Native Americans. And I was looking in particular at how their theology bends and sways under the pressure of politics. So you can see certain themes within their theology emerging in peacetime and then other themes in war, but also looking at how their theology itself changes depending on who they're fighting against. So I finished that in 2018. And I've been working on some other projects since then. But I never intended to write a book on Donald Trump. I intended to just give about a 20-minute lecture on how Protestants interpreted history, either to support or oppose him. And initially, my thought was simply that the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims arriving at Plymouth will coincide, or it did coincide, a few months ago with the re-election campaign of Donald Trump. So I was looking at those two events together and simply thought that it would be an interesting topic to give a short lecture on, and became really engrossed in it and found that there really are three competing and in some ways incompatible ways that American Protestants view their own history. And was putting the final touches of this as the debate about history really boiled over after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And so really trying to understand what are the larger and longer narratives that American Protestants are telling themselves about the past, and how does this contribute to the polarization that we see in the present?
Well, thanks, Matt. That's really interesting. So you've said that this study seeks to understand three different ways that Americans, particularly Protestant Christian leaders, look at the history of colonial America. So could you, for a moment, sketch out some of these alternatives, and then we'll talk about each one of them in a moment.
Sure. The the three groups that I'm roughly looking at, I restricted myself to Protestants who wrote books during the Trump presidency. So I didn't go into the blogosphere, didn't go into, you know, all of the other possible sources of information. I looked strictly at books, and I was looking particularly at how do they respond to Make America Great Again? So the final word of Trump's slogan is fundamentally a historical claim. So we see in it, Trump really is wrapping a statement about national decline around a vision of progress. So he's trying at the same time to say, you know, it was the best of times, or it will be the best of times, and it's currently the worst of times. And he's trying to restore something, but there's fundamental disagreement over what it is that Trump is aiming to restore. And so I argue that some Protestants have what I've called the inclusive interpretation of Make America Great Again. And that inclusive interpretation is essentially Make America Great Again for all Americans. And so we see that some Americans think that MAGA is a very inclusive claim. And on the other side, there's the exclusive interpretation of MAGA. And that is Make America Great Again for white Christian males. And we see that some people, particularly those who are white Christian nationalists, tend to argue for that. But then you also see the Protestant left who really fundamentally disagrees with Trump. They similarly argue that Trump is trying to restore American greatness only for white Christian males. And so looking at, you know, Trump basically sparked this massive debate about history through his slogan and through the different things that he's advocated over the last 4 years. And I divided the Protestant response to Trump into three different groups. The first is Make America Great Again Protestants. And then these Protestants fundamentally want to take America back to what made it great between 1620 and 1950. And we can talk a little bit more about each of these groups later. But so Make America Great Again Protestants want to restore what made America great between 1920 and 1950. Make America Lament Protestants fundamentally want Americans to come to terms with their history of racism, sexism, and exploitation. So when these Protestants hear the call to make America great again, they want to say America was never great. And therefore, we shouldn't be trying to restore some kind of mythical greatness. What we should do is confront our past so that we can make America great for the first time for everybody. The third group of Protestants I've called Make America Better. And these Protestants, actually, they tend to take on board all of the critiques of the Make America Lament position. So they think it is valuable, it's useful, it's necessary to focus on the racism and the sexism and exploitation that are inseparable from America's past. But they go one step beyond that, and they move on to actually appreciate America's past. Flawed individuals, flawed documents, flawed institutions, though they be in the past. The Make America Better Protestants can't say America was ever great, but they can agree that we can use the past, use what is best in the past in order to move America towards confronting racism, sexism, and exploitation in the present. So the first two positions are largely incompatible. And I argue throughout that they only emphasize one part of America's history, and therefore they're not really able to have much of a dialogue. And I put forward the Make America Better position as more faithful to the complexity of America's past and able to bridge the divide so that the pursuit of justice in the present can be a bipartisan effort.
That's really fascinating, Matt. I'm especially interested with the way that you're talking about this inclusive, exclusive interpretation of MAGA as not necessarily a partisan or polarized phenomenon, but it actually can kind of cut both ways. before you then move it into those three different ideologies that you're describing. Is that, am I hearing that correct?
Yes. And I think recognizing the divisive skill that Donald Trump has. One author described him as having the Moses touch, being able to plant his stake in the ground anywhere and divide the sea before him. And I think we want to often think that the divides are very clear, but he has actually divided Americans in so many interesting ways. I mean, even just looking at the 2020 election, with his percentage of votes among minorities increasing during that time. That's the exact opposite of what you would expect, but he's really divided. He has absolutely divided our nation, but it's been anything but clear divides. It cuts through denominations. It cuts through racial groups. It cuts through genders. And so I was kind of trying to explore those complexities.
Yeah. Matt, I was really intrigued by the end of this kind of introductory section of your book. You make a comment about your empathetic approach. So before we get into these different groups, what are the cost-benefit ratios of careful reading of each different position? What are the rewards or the dangers? Are you meaning to equivocate these different options, or is there something different that you're after?
Yes. So perhaps I'll jump back into 17th century history, something you and I are both familiar with. I studied massacres for my PhD, and I was never satisfied with my analysis until I could imagine myself doing similar things if I was in those circumstances. And so I used empathy throughout the PhD to try to, as best as I possibly could, recreate the thought processes of those that I was studying. And so when I apply that to modern history, we're often told that empathy shuts down critique. And I want to say that empathy is the place where good critique starts. You can only truly critique after you have empathized with a position. And so what I try to do throughout is say, as best as I can, get into the head of somebody who believes that Donald Trump is their protector and believes that his vision for America is best. And I wasn't satisfied with my analysis of a Trump supporter until I could see myself acting, thinking, speaking as they did. And then I flipped around and tried to look at the people who are viscerally opposed to President Trump and look at their thought processes and empathize as much as I can. And often, often you run into limits with a lot of these things because so much of the opposition to Trump is based on things like racism and sexism. And as a white male, it can be very hard for me to feel those things, but I've tried my best to listen to what made people so fearful of the slogan "Make America Great Again," and what made them so fearful of this vision of restoring American greatness. And then I tried to put that into words. And so I think that one of the fundamental things we need to do is in America is reframe empathy so that it becomes a tool of critique, not the opposite of critique.
Yeah, Matt, I thought that was really insightful. You made the comment that in trying to empathize with different sides of this conversation, you're not necessarily trying to engage in the good people on both sides kind of argumentation, but instead that people on different sides of this debate feel like they have really good reasons for holding their beliefs. So let's get into this first group. This is the Make America Great Again crowd. Who are some of the key leaders within American Protestantism? How are they reading American history? And what kind of continuities are they seeking to highlight?
So in the first group, Make America Great Again, I was looking at a whole bunch of authors and pastors and journalists. And the authors that I settled on were Robert Jeffress, Cal Thomas, Os Guinness, Eric Metaxas, Michael Brown, and a whole cadre of what I've called prophecy or prophecy experts. And these Protestants carry around a burden of memories containing court cases that marginalize God and Christian ethics in the public square. So they feel very burdened by American history, and this often has to do with the courts. They argue that America turned from its founding, most notably in the 1950s, and restoring American greatness, therefore, involves recovering what made America great between the 1920s and the 1950s. These Protestants believe that opponents of American greatness denigrate a noble and uplifting past. The left, they think, runs through American history with chisel and axe, toppling anything that falls short of their liberal platform. So they very much position themselves as defenders of sanity, defenders of American history, defenders of godliness in the public sphere. And so they don't want to necessarily restore the world to the state that it was in 1950. But what they want to do is, in essence, bring back the best parts of it. And the best in their perspective is often has to do with the way that the church was, the church's relationship with the state and with law. So how do these Protestants in the Make America Great Again group, how do they deal with America's history of racism, sexism, and exploitation? What I found is that pretty much all of them acknowledge these negative aspects of America's past, which actually surprised me. But what they do is they usually only devote about one paragraph of their book to looking at the sins of America. They tend to, you know, they say America was great. Oh yeah, and there was this thing called slavery, but we outgrew that. And so they acknowledge the past, but almost in a way that dismisses the deep hurt. And in dismissing the hurt, they also cut off the past from the present. So they almost want to segregate something like slavery in the past and say, you know, the racism that produced slavery is in the past, but it ended and it doesn't continue to impact the present. There is no systemic problem with racism in the present. So they're very much wanting to just restore the good, and they almost quarantine the negative aspects of America's past. So in the present, these Protestants argue that America needs to admire the individuals, ideas, and events that made America great, and then Americans will be moved to greatness. Perhaps the best articulation of this was Trump's 2020 Mount Rushmore speech, where he is arguing that by focusing on the negative in America's past, Americans themselves will become harsh, judgmental, unforgiving, and self-righteous. But by focusing on the good, Americans will be moved to goodness. And this is essentially Norman Vincent Peale's power of positive thinking applied to history. So you almost create the great American history by telling yourself that American history is great. Other Protestants, as we'll discuss, feel like this is a very harmful way of viewing America's past that allows injustices in the present to go unchallenged.
That's really interesting, Matt. I'm curious if you think that there might be, because we're primarily focusing here in this discussion on Christian leaders, pastors, and journalists. What sort of theological underpinnings might be giving the foundation for this particular kind of a Christian approach to history? You've started to allude to this a little bit with your reference to the work of Norman Vincent Peale. But how might this be an outworking of a certain way of approaching Christian theology?
Yeah, I think related to Norman Vincent Peale's book, if you read it, confession doesn't play a big role. Focusing on failure doesn't play a big role in that. And that's a very common thing. So in the same way that a lot of Protestants who support Trump are willing to basically, I would say that they have an overactive forgiveness complex. And that applies both to America's past and to America's present. So forgiveness is a good thing, but forgiveness can operate within your thinking in a way that shuts off the ability to empathize with people who are hurting, the ability to see things from other people's perspectives, or the ability to confront wrongs. And so you see with Donald Trump, there has been a continual lack of a willingness among many Protestants to confront either his past or the statements or policies that he's had in the present, precisely because they talk about how forgiving God is. And I would say that that's an overactive sort of forgiveness that cuts off critical thinking in a lot of ways. And that same kind of forgiveness is often applied to the past. So, you know, the past, yes, we know the bad stuff happened, 50 years ago, a century ago, 2 centuries ago, we know that stuff happened. But what we need to do is essentially look over it, have grace for the past, and, you know, take what is best and apply it to the present. So I would say that's one of the main things that I see going on. Also, I think John Fee has talked about fear, power, and nostalgia as three important factors that are at play here. So evangelicals in particular, he said that you could write the entire history of evangelicalism through the lens of fear. And so this sense of embattlement that has been going on for a very long time of, you know, the Christian against the world, and the world is trying to destroy, the world is attacking. Some elements of evangelicalism are incredibly fearful, and Trump has come in as the protector, which his second thing, fear, power, nostalgia. And my book is very much about the nostalgia part. But that in the fearfulness, they have reached out for a protector. And Trump represents that for them.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's right. I think it's in relation to this group that you talked about gaslighting. What was how are you understanding that term? This is a term that gets thrown around a lot, but I don't know that we always know exactly what we're talking about when we use it. So, but you acknowledge that that's a real concern with this Make America Great Again group. How is that playing out?
Yes. So in part of my trying to empathize as best I can with the Make America Great Again crowd, I float the idea that there's a form of gaslighting that goes on. So gaslighting is mental manipulation where you are told that you're not experiencing something you're experiencing. And the most common way in which gaslighting occurs is in racial discourse. So somebody has clearly experienced racism, and then they're told, oh, you're not experiencing racism. And so the person is almost made to doubt that they had just experienced something that was racist. So I take the, you know, I apply this idea of gaslighting to what is going on with Protestants who supported Trump. So in essence, you look at various places in America and various white communities in America, And the unemployment is incredibly high. Drug addiction is very high. You know, people have left them, forgotten them. Their healthcare is very low. Education levels are low. And they're in essence told that you have white privilege. And they're saying, I don't feel any of this privilege. I don't feel any of this, but you know, basically we're the forgotten Americans and you're making me feel guilty about my skin color. You're making me feel as if I have some advantages because of my skin color. Where are the advantages? And so that's the first form of gaslighting that I talk about. The second form is, the second form has to do with how quickly the country is changing. And people on the left will say, they'll applaud how quickly the country is changing. So the country, you know, look at you know, where we were in relation to sexuality at the beginning of Obama's presidency, and then look 4 years later and 4 years later, progress, 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 change, 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 and it's put in terms of good. And then at the same time, those same people will turn around to Trump supporters and say, you're changing America. You're fundamentally altering the American landscape. And what that does for the typical Trump supporter is that actually causes them to dig in deeper and say, you know, there was a slippery slope and we should have dug in 4 decades ago, 3 decades ago. We should have been all the more adamant on making our faith impact politics, because now we've seen where it leads to. And so what you see in the present is a doubling down on the sense of embattlement because they're trying to make up for lost ground. And they get very frustrated because at the same time they're being told that they're changing America while the left is saying, yay, we're changing America. And it's this sense of gaslighting, like, you know, you're causing me to doubt what I'm seeing with my own eyes.
Fascinating. Well, I'd like to move down to the second group. So you've talked about the Make America Great Again group of Protestants. Now, who are the Make America Lament Protestants, and what do they mean by that?
Sure. In the second category, I'm dealing with authors Sherry Faye Rosendahl, Cornel West, Michael Eric Dyson, Jamar Tisby, Jonathan Walton, Jonathan Wilson Hargrove, Mark Charles, and Soon-Shan Ra. And these authors, when they hear the call to make America great again, they want to make America lament. And what they mean by lament is, in one sense, it's looking at the past. Look at the history of racism, sexism, land grabbing, and exploitation. Look at that, feel it deeply, lament it deeply. And lament for them tends to not be an exclusive thing. I think when we think of, you know, when you think, oh, somebody wants to make you lament, it's often put in terms of, you know, they want to make you feel bad. They want to make you, you know, but that's not the main sense. I think that they actually put lament as a very intimate thing. So they want to, in essence, invite the white population of America into a funeral, which is very, it's a very intimate thing. They're trying to invite Americans into the pain of what it means to be marginalized in America. It's often interpreted as, you know, they're trying to create this big division between white people and people of color, or, you know, men and women, or whatever the fault lines are. But I honestly think their vision of lament is very much trying to share their pain so that the groups can become closer together. So this group is burdened, as I mentioned, the Make America Great Again Protestants are burdened by mainly court cases that they think move the country away from God. These Make America Lament Protestants are burdened by injustices that date back to the colonial era. most notably land theft, slavery, and female subordination. They argue vigorously that the past is not in the past, and they cite ongoing injustices in forms that range from voter suppression to the new Jim Crow to police brutality. Present-day gaps in wealth, education, incarceration, health, for example, are directly connected to these injustices. So whereas the previous group will only talk about these injustices in one paragraph, this group wants to almost talk exclusively about these injustices. And they want to highlight them and place them front and center in America's history. But more than that, they want to argue that the past is not past. It barges into the present all the time in no-knock search warrants. It barges into the present when the police are putting a knee on a person's neck. And so they want to really connect history, connect the past to the present, instead of, you know, walling off slavery as the previous group does. They want to say, oh no, there is far too much continuity between slavery and the present. Hmm. So when these Americans hear claims of American greatness, they fear that this denies, dismisses, or glorifies America's racist, sexist, land-grabbing past. And many of them actually worry that MAGA is a way of turning back the clock on progress. So it's, you know, not trying to restore what is best in America's past, but Trump wants to restore this nostalgic time when, you know, white male Christianity was dominant. So even though these Protestants might admire deeply flawed historical persons in the past, they tend to not say anything nice about them. And I think this is very strategic. I think that their fear is that, you know, if they, let's take George Washington, for example, if they critique George Washington, critique, and then throw on a praise at the end, they're worried that Trump supporters will only hear the praise and will not hear the critique. And so these Protestants tend to be allergic to saying anything positive about America's past. These are kind of the fault lines. The Make America Great Again is worried about critiquing the past. If you critique the past, you're a Marxist. And the other side is worried about, you know, about praising the past, because if you praise the past, then you won't confront historic injustices that continue to impact the present.
How are you seeing this call to make America lament emerging out of the Protestant convictions of this group?
I think Protestantism is constantly reevaluating itself. It's one incredibly long argument, and often a very diverse argument. Right from the beginning, almost immediately after 1517, it's been a diverse argument. And each generation of Protestants critiques the one before. It's a very natural thing that happens. Obviously, there's a lot of continuity, a lot of appreciation through the past. But I think that the Make America Lament group is tapping into a very long tradition of minority Protestants who have critiqued the injustice of the country that they lived in. So you can go way back into the 18th century, and you find Native American Protestant ministers and African American Protestant ministers who are really holding up a mirror to the nations that they live in and saying, you know, you profess this. You profess that you are a Christ-like society. This is what you are really like. And so I think that these Protestants are tapping into that much longer tradition, but they're also very much tapping into the Hebrew Bible. The entire Hebrew Bible, as Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has said, is one long narrative of national self-critique. Hmm. And so they're very much taking on that prophetic role, not prophetic in the sense of, you know, telling the future, but prophetic in the sense the Hebrew Bible prophetic sense, or one of the senses of the prophet standing against the nation and pointing out the failures. And they very much adopt that role.
Yeah, that's really great, Matt. So you've outlined these two fault lines, as you called it, and then you now present a third group, which you're calling Make America Better. Is this just some kind of Goldilocks mediating position halfway between the two groups, or are you seeing this mapping in a different way altogether?
Yes. So this third group of Protestants, they want to make America better. They're uncomfortable with claims of national greatness. So when Trump supporters, you know, have their MAGA flags and, you know, talk about how great it was in the past, they will just say that that's not reality. That's not real history. That America never existed. But they also worry that being imbalanced on the other side, so only critiquing the past, actually cuts you off from the ability to fight against injustice in the present. So their writings emphasize that there has always been two Americas. There was the founding ideal and the founding reality. The reality was unequal and unjust, but the ideal laid the groundwork for justice and equality. In other words, America's enduring racism and the drive for equality flow from the same source. Therefore, these Protestants argue that historical persons, institutions, or documents should not be wholly rejected or totally embraced. So they have a very complex view with the past. They don't look at Abraham Lincoln and say he was only the great emancipator. They're also willing to say, oh, he was adamantly against intermarriage. He did not want equality with blacks. And somehow all of those things coexist in this person of Abraham Lincoln, who is simultaneously admirable and revulsive. And they hold those two things in tension. And in reference to your Goldilocks question, I argue that this isn't a position between the other two groups. It's actually a crucial step beyond the Make America Lament position. So having lamented America's past, having looked at it and really tried to see what went wrong in American history, these Protestants go one step further and they try to say, you know, what can we use in the past in order to confront injustice in the present? It's a crucial step beyond it. In addition to lamenting, they add a tempered and qualified appreciation of the flawed figures of America's past. And they also, like the Make America Lament position, they note how the past barges into the present constantly. And that's a negative thing, and that's also a positive thing. So the good in America's past barges into the present and helps us to confront injustices. And also the negative things in America's past barge into the present. The news this last summer has been full of those accounts. So if the Make America Great Again Protestants have a hard time articulating what went wrong in American history, Make America Lament Protestants have a hard time articulating what went right. And I argue that the Make America Better Protestants frame the critique of historical justice as an act of patriotism. So it's actually patriotic to remove the plaster that previous generations put over historical evil. And I think that's really important, this framing that they do. Critiquing the nation for these Protestants is not a sign of disloyalty, but of national maturity. So America has come of age when it can squarely face its past.
Matt, who might be some of the models and leaders of this particular group who are moving to this, as you say, critical step beyond Make America Lament and into Make America Better?
Yeah, in many ways, this is the most diverse group. And I tend to think that the majority of American Protestants could happily reside here. They're being told that they have to choose between the other two polarized positions. But I think that there's actually a very large middle group that wants to confront America's past, wants to look at the past and see how it impacts the present. But they're being told that they have to take an imbalanced position on either side. So in this category, I looked at the works of David N. Moore, Van Jones, Jim Wallace, Eric Mason, John Fee, and Marilyn Robinson.
So Matt, you've given this study that shows three different ways that Protestant Christians in America really differently read history. What are the lessons that we can take from this for approaches to history that you find to be most fruitful and faithful?
So a few of the things, the first you could put in terms of historical awareness, and then the second category I'd put in terms of temperament. I think that Americans in general, Protestant Americans in particular, really need to learn our history better. And one of the big things that I see that is dividing Americans is the fact that there is a 100-year memory gap. Basically from the Emancipation Proclamation to the Montgomery bus boycott, many Americans have no idea what happened there in that 100 years. Of course, they can name key events that were central to white history. So they can, you know, World War I, World War II, other events like that. They know these major events that happen, but they don't really know the history of, they don't know Native American history during that time period. They don't know what was happening to the freed slaves. And so what I argue in the book is that there's this 100-year memory gap that basically connects slavery with the civil rights movement. And so it almost seems as if the civil rights movement, in many people's thinking, pops out of nowhere. But it has a very long history, and often it's in that 100-year period that many whites in America tried to reduce people of color to back to their position of slavery, often under different terms. And that's a history of mass incarceration. That's a history of inequality in 100 different ways. And so Americans really need to learn to confess this past and say, you know, this past happened, but they also need to learn to connecting the dots between past injustice and the present. So confessing America's past, connecting the dots, those are two historical things that I think need to happen. And the things related to temperament, I would put three, and those are curiosity, empathy, and self-critique. And very briefly on those, I think Americans need to become more curious about their fellow Americans. Half the country votes differently than you. And I see almost a total lack of curiosity as to why your neighbor thinks differently than you do. Often it's put in terms of, you know, evil or deluded. And those just are not satisfactory answers. You might not find that you agree with somebody, but I think there should be more curiosity as to why your beliefs are not shared by everybody. We've already talked about empathy, reframing empathy as the start of critique, and empathy as something that sharpens critique. Empathy should not be viewed as disloyalty, but as a very useful tool in bridging polarization and offering accurate critique. And the third thing is, I think that self-critique needs to be reframed as a virtue. So we need more Republicans who are willing to critique Republicans. We need more Democrats willing to critique Democrats, more atheists willing to critique atheists, more Christians willing to critique Christianity. And I think that if we reframe self-critique as a positive thing, reframe it as something that is vital to the health of any movement, then we won't have these polarized positions where one side says it's all good and the other side says it's all bad. And often the best critiques are the ones that come from within any given tradition. And so I think Americans need to be more curious. We need more empathy, and we need to reframe self-critique as a positive good.
Wonderful, Matt. It's really helpful. Well, you've been so generous with your time with us today. Before we say goodbye, could you tell us a little bit about what you're working on next?
Yes, I have several projects that I'm working on. So the main one is a reader in Protestant political thought. This will be a 2-volume global history, and it's collecting sources from around the world and looking, these are sources on war, on toleration, on slavery, on emancipation, on freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry, women's rights to vote, women's rights to hold office. All of these debates took place within Protestant spheres. Protestants played an important role in them. And it's really highlighting both the prominent voices like John Locke or Roger Williams, but also a lot of the forgotten voices, particularly Protestant political theorists who were minorities or women. Voices like Arjula von Grumbach, who wrote a treatise on academic freedom. I think it came out in 1523, and she was one of the most widely read Protestants of her day, but is almost unheard of at the present. So it's really trying to recover a lot of these voices and finding that in Protestant, in just about every debate in Protestant history, people have lined up on exact opposite sides. And so you'll have sources that think toleration should not exist, and other sources that say that Christ demands toleration, or pro-slavery, anti-slavery. It's trying to provide a one-stop shop for the good, the bad, and the ugly in how Protestants related politics with their faith.
Excellent.
So I'm working on that. I'm about to finish an edited volume on the relationship between miracles, political authority, and violence. And that one's mainly focusing on the medieval and early modern world. But in reality, it stretches from the ancient Near East all the way up to the siege on the Capitol on January 6th. There was an enormous amount of miraculous language in the 2 months leading up to opposition to Joe Biden and the siege on the Capitol. So I'm giving a 5,000 year overview of the relationship between miracles and violence. And that'll be coming out maybe at the end of this year with Routledge. Okay. And then I'm doing some work at the University of Leicester, way down on the ladder of importance on William Wilberforce's diaries. So those are being prepared for an Oxford University Press edition.
Fantastic. Those all sound like very fruitful projects, and I can't wait to follow the work as you continue to develop it. Well, once again, we've been talking to Dr. Matthew Rowley, author of the new book, Trump and the Protestant Reaction to Make America Great Again, available now from Routledge. I hope you give it a read. I trust you will find it offers much needed clarity into our current state of religion and politics in America. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to New Books in Christian Studies. Follow our podcast wherever you like to listen and visit newbooksnetwork.com to find more great interviews. Tell your friends if you enjoy this episode, and until next time, I hope you have a great day.